Welcome to the nuts and bolts session. I see you've already found the Breer. All right, take a drink. I see you've already found the Bratzen beer and perhaps the occasional burger. We would like to thank our sponsors for that. Resonant Results, Rich Wood, thank you very much. Rich. The entire team from Shively Labs. Anybody in the room? Without that beer, I wouldn't be half as funny, and even that's debatable. We thank you for being here tonight. We plan to have a lot of fun with this. Oh, thank you for that. The beer is courtesy of the Marriott. I'll drink to that. The really nice thing about this session is that the more you drink, the funnier I am. And it works about that well, apparently. I'll ask that question again in an hour. We'll see what happens. We're going to have a good time with this tonight, and we're doing something a little bit different. We have an actual presentation, but I'll give you my personal guarantee and the $12 bill I have in my pocket that you'll enjoy it. Bill Pritchett has 33 years' experience as an educator and is a master's graduate of Ball State University. He's a precision aerobatic national champion and continues to actively fly and participate in model aviation. He's currently serving as director of education of the Academy of Model Aeronautics. Among his many accomplishments in his current role, Bill has created the AMA, American Model Aeronautics Flight School online resource. I'd like to present Bill Pritchett and Archie Stafford to send in the drones. There ought to be drones. Well, maybe they're here. Because it's so much better than me droning on and on and on about that. You've heard these all before, haven't you?
About the beer and that, so see you later.
Bye.
I won't quit my day job.
Well, hi, everybody. Thanks a lot for having us. Linda Bawn. If you haven't taken the time to personally thank her, and I can also say from experience of doing many, many of these kinds of events, Bill Hubbard, Gary, there's some great, great folks here, and maybe you're used to it. I'm not, okay? But you have a top drawer event here, and it's extremely well organized, and I'd just like to say thank you, and thanks for having us. Bill mentioned that this is informal. I fly model airplanes for a living, so I'm all about informal, okay? The AMA Flight School is my baby, and I'll just talk briefly about some things here. I promise you this is not going to be death by PowerPoint. I promise you, okay? I've been on the other end of that. And you know, PowerPoint's funny. It's like we all hate them, but if you don't have them, you're nobody. I don't know. There's some kind of void there. I'm still working on that. But anyway, the Academy of Model Aeronautics, next summer, will celebrate 80 years. We have 175,000-plus members nationally, 50,000 youth members. You can read a $10 million annual budget and an 1,100-acre international flying site in beautiful Muncie, Indiana. How many of you have ever been to Muncie, Indiana? Have another beer on me. Twice. Have two beers. So there's some membership benefits. If you want to join, knock yourself out. We'd love to have you. Flying an SUAS is a pretty cool thing. This photograph of the Ford test track in Detroit was taken totally by accident. We were doing a video event for the Henry Ford Museum. And Arch was flying the SUAS. I was flying the camera. We do that oftentimes to separate, put the platform in a position, and then we can fly the camera with tilt and pan and focus and all that independently of the platform carrying the camera. And we got up in the air and looked around, and lo and behold, we had no idea the Ford test track was right across the street. What a great picture. So we are very much into SUAS training. And you know, I mentioned that we're an 80-year-old organization next year and that I fly model airplanes for a living, and that's true. I'm a model airplane guy. And of course, model helicopters are very popular. And now we have this new thing, and you know what they're called? Drones. Yeah. Well, you can, since you guys aren't journalists, I can say we can thank the journalists for that. You know, a drone was a target aircraft in World War II that fighter planes went after to shoot down. And then I remember in the Desert Storm, sitting at home watching on TV, a model airplane with a camera flying over some bad guys. They all threw up their hands, threw down their weapons, surrendered to a model airplane. And I thought, wow, that's cool. They just did that with a model airplane. Well, they knew that with the telemetry that they were getting from that model airplane, that the Black Hawk helicopters would be coming up over the hill soon. So they just threw in the towel, as it were, okay? But fortunately, we have the FAA. Uh-huh. And fortunately, the FAA has told me that I don't fly model airplanes. I fly an SUAS. I fly a small unmanned aircraft system. Really. So when we refer to SUAS, training, we're talking about all three platforms, okay? We're talking about fixed wing, we're talking about rotary wing, and we're talking about the multi-rotors, the drones, okay? I've given up. I call them drones too, okay? And there are lots of issues about that that we'll get into as this session goes on a little bit, but I want you to understand that as an organization, as a person, as someone involved in this industry and hobby, I'm very passionate about making sure that you understand that even though the sign out there is drones, 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 or the drones are coming on the cover of Time magazine or whatever it is, the SUAS phenomenon for the Academy of Model Aeronautics is the biggest opportunity or the biggest dark hole we've seen in our history. Time will tell. So in our course that we have from Fly Robotics is a company that we use to include an online course. It's built on Moodle, and you can go to amaflightschool.org and see a preview of that. We cover virtually every topic to address the NPRM that the FAA released. The NPRM is the National Proposal for Rulemaking, okay? If you don't like acronyms, stay away from aviation. Okay, so they have the NPRM and they release rules the same way, so you guys get that, cool. So, the next slide here is just another picture of the course, what is an SUAS, and we cover all kinds of things there. And this is probably the most important part about what we're doing right now and how we're addressing the whole drone phenomenon. Because if you haven't noticed, there are some folks that are buying these things and doing some pretty stupid things with them. I mean, honestly, the guy that got the $1.9 million fine, that company, maybe you saw that a couple weeks ago, he's flying in Class B airspace in New York. That's just over the top wrong, okay? There's not a reason to be doing that. And I'm sure the FAA wanted to put him up on the pole and, you know, make him an example, and I get that to a certain degree. But that was not a good choice. So ethical and safe airmanship is a huge part of what we do. Okay? This is a great quote. Flying is so many parts skill, so many parts planning, maintenance, and so many parts luck. The trick is to reduce the luck by increasing the others. Before you fly, and again, all of this is available online, but when I say before you fly, I'm not going to ask yet, I will in a little bit, but my guess is that some of you have a multirotor. Okay? Industry projections, this Christmas alone, 1 million will be sold. That's a lot of drones, folks. Okay? 1 million of them, all right? So they all operate on lithium polymer batteries. If you've not had an experience with the lithium polymer battery, you should know a little bit about them before you deal with them. My guess is that as engineers, you guys understand all that. If you're new to this whole phenomenon, you know, there's nothing better than finding someone who knows more than you and saying, hey, can you give me a hand? How does this work? Familiar yourself with weather, check weather reports, manufacturers' limitations on wind, don't fly in rain, and temperatures have an impact on any SUAS. More safety stuff, do not fly within 3 nautical miles of an airport, and that's a lot of common sense, okay? The FAA has proposed, and the AMA has fought it tooth and nail, to make that 5 miles. That may not sound like much, but if they change it from 3 miles to 5 miles, there would be no place to fly anything, model airplanes, helicopters, whatever, in the state of New Jersey. It'd all be covered. Familiarize yourself and adhere with FAA advisories and the AMA safety code. The safety code, you know, is really a lot of common sense. I've heard common sense used in this group today about a dozen times. In just conversations I hear walking by, and you know, common sense is such a lost art sometimes, but our safety code, the three things about common sense is don't fly over people. Don't fly over property, okay? And don't photograph people that haven't given you permission to. I mean, that's common sense. Brief the flight, fly the brief. Know what you're gonna do and then do it. Keep track of your batteries and their conditions. Here's some things to consider during flight. A couple of you may not want to fly tonight, never operate under the influence of drugs or alcohol, but because we are indoors, knock them down, the FAA doesn't deal with indoor flight. So, you know, knock yourself out. Get really drunk and give it a try. What are ethics? Knowing the difference between what you have the right to do and what is right to do. So, ethical airmanship, I think probably the most important thing here is that laws and regulations may set limits. There's no replacement for quality decision making. Okay? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Risk management in flying a drone cannot replace quality decision making. Situational awareness, again, am I flying over people? Am I flying over property? Am I going to be operating a camera, taking pictures of people that don't expect that or have given permission? Risk management, very, very critical. Weather is really important, okay? as recently as a week ago, flying this very multi-rotor at our headquarters in Muncie. I turned it on. It was my second flight with it. They just sent it in, and you know, I turned it on, the lights beeped, and old model airplane guy, I thought, well, this is good. This is good to go. I took off, and there's about a 25-mile-an-hour wind directly out of the south, and it just went like that, straight for the headquarters building. I thought, this isn't good. Add power, raised altitude. Now it's headed for the pond on the other side of the headquarters building. When I realized that I had to flip it off to safety mode, fly it manually, it was a piece of cake, flew it back, landed it. I had not waited for the GPS initialization to complete. Okay? When this thing really hooks up and links up, I've seen it show as many as 19 satellites that it's connected to. So it has a pretty good idea of where you are. And what the GPS connection does is give you an incredible amount of stability in terms of where it is. Not this kind of stability, that's a different thing. But in terms of keeping it right here, where you want it, that's really, really a big deal. Ethical airmanship, again, sound decision making. And every time you fly in public, you're going to be representing everyone that owns a drone, model airplane, model helicopter. And you know, it always makes me laugh, even though I wrote this, that the last thing I put on here is have fun. And you're probably sitting there thinking, how in the hell can I have fun? There's nothing but things I can't do. Well, we're going to talk about that in a second. Okay, we're not going to get into questions yet, but a couple things I want to talk about before Arch does a flight demonstration here with this particular thing. You know, privacy is a pretty big deal in the news right now. And I've always been amazed that someone looks at one of these and feels threatened that their privacy is you know, somehow being attacked by any one of us flying a drone. I mean, you may still have an Instamatic camera and a ladder at home. And if you want to look over the neighbor's fence and look at the pool, I don't know. There are ways to invade someone's privacy without one of these. So it goes back to that good decision making. The fantastic thing about a drone is also the very worst thing about it. It's so easy to fly. If you can play solitaire on your laptop, you're qualified. I'm sorry. Okay. But seriously, you are. Because they are so easy to fly, that is also why people get them and misuse them. Okay? So, what you're going to see here, and Linda, this is always the part in the show where I say to our host, I would say, Linda, and what we're going to do now is we're going to fly this, and while it's flying, it's going to take some 4X video and photographs of the entire crowd, and they're all going to be waving, and I'm going to send them to you. I'm not going to do that tonight. TSA decided to rip the camera off the bottom of this, and yeah, you know, so there you go. I apologize for that because that's always, you know, then I can send it to you and, you know, all that. So, but anyway, TSA had other plans. So what you're going to see here, because we're indoors, is totally a manual flight. It is all what Arch is doing with the sticks. There's no GPS lock or anything of where it is. And you can get an idea of what that looks like, feels like, sounds like, and all that. Now, what this particular model will do is it will allow you from the transmitter to start and stop videos, to take individual photographs, and to tilt the camera up and down. The pan is in rotating the axis of the platform. So like right now, he'd be going back and forth, kind of getting everyone like so. And if he wanted to take a picture of himself, he'd just have to rotate it around so that it's looking at him. Flight time without any wind, 15 minutes easily. This is the Horizon Chroma. Horizon Hobbies Chroma. And it's got a mini SD card in it. And I think it's like crazy, like 3 hours of 4X video that you can put on it. We're with the Wisconsin State Board of Health. We're gonna take pictures. Just kidding. So typical questions beyond how long will it fly on a battery charge? Again, 15 to 20 minutes. Another question is how high will it go? Higher than you can see it, and therefore you have left one of our basic protocols for flight, line of sight. Okay, you've got to remain within line of sight. The question here was, isn't there an FAA rule that you can't go over 400 feet? That is not a rule, that's an advisory, okay? And the reason for that advisory is the minimum altitude of general aviation is 500 feet. So in a perfect world, you have a 100-foot buffer between, you know, the Cessna 172 and this. In reality, at a model club anywhere in the United States, we're over that all the time. But again, we're in a place where that's appropriate, not within 3 miles of an airport. So line of sight is very critical. It can go higher than you can see it. Okay. Hey, by the way, history was made tonight. Did you know that history was made tonight? Cubs won. I saw the hat. Okay, is there any telemetry on it that gives you your altitude? On the screen of the transmitter, it will tell you your exact GPS latitude, longitude, location, your altitude, how far it is in linear feet from you, and your ground speed. Constantly updated digitally. Now, you know, in fairness, what Arch is doing there, and you should know that Arch is one of the best UAV guys in the United States. Let's give him a nice round of applause here, because. He made that look easy, and what he just did there was completely manual flight. There was nothing automated about that. To answer your question about telemetry, did that cover it for you? And it always cracks me up because, you know, one of our basic rules for flight is line of sight, right? We've got to be able to see it. And yet, everything about that asks you to not watch it. You know, because on the screen is your monitor for your camera. Okay, it's a great little color monitor for your camera. It's giving you all that telemetry of where you are, how fast you're going, your altitude. Tells you how much battery power you have left on the multi-rotor. It tells you how much battery power you have left in the transmitter. It tells you all this information, and it's like, why do I want to watch that? I want to look at all this. But line of sight. Yes, sir. Okay.
Over here.
Got a microphone on the way.
This one first.
All right. It's been said that on a clear day, you can see forever.
Uh-huh. That's a okay. great tune.
So the distance from you, as long as it does not exceed 400 feet up elevation-wise, would be the limitation of the transmitter itself?
No, but there's really... The transmitter would probably be effective to what?
Well, we did the tests at Muncie, and it was about 3/4 of a mile you could actually physically see it. And that was a perfectly clear day. And that was pushing what I would consider being able to see it and tell what's going on. Your transmitter is several miles, but while you may be able to see forever, by definition, visual line of sight, you have to be able to tell what it's actually doing.
Well, you got lights on, so... Is there day or nighttime provisions when you can fly these things?
Currently, the way that the FAA's NPRM is there will be no nighttime operations initially from a commercial standpoint. From a hobby standpoint, we fly at night all the time.
Yeah, we fly at night all the time. And to further talk about your question, you can see it farther away than you can see it to fly it. Because you lose perspective on, is that the front, the back, the side? It's like a speck. And you could technically say, yeah, I can see it. Okay, well, what are you going to do with it? Well, you don't know because you don't have a reference of front, back, and left, and right. So there's that. Yeah, something about... ethics and good decision making.
And one of the things we found is most of the commercial applications you'll be able to do line of sight anyway. I mean, for a realtor, you've got access to the property you're taking pictures of. I mean, even from a journalistic standpoint, you're probably going to be at the accident or whatever you're trying to get pictures of. So for most of the applications for multi-rotor, there's not really a reason to fly that far out anyway, nor are they efficient enough to be able to justify long distance flight.
Okay. I just wanted to ask, is it possible to program the drone, say you've got a tower at a particular latitude, longitude, and you want to do a vertical survey of that tower, and you're starting from certain coordinates, can you pre-program the drone to basically fly a certain flight plan?
Absolutely. A lot of the ones now have waypoint capabilities on them. Most of them, from 3D robotics and such, you can literally sit at the computer and program. DJI has some safety features built into the Phantom and the Inspire that actually require you to fly the flight plan prior to being able to save a waypoint. So the advantage to that is it won't let you fly it into a tree. It makes you fly to the point and save it. But absolutely, you can. Tower inspection is one of the big things that I know. I actually know some guys that are doing that currently.
What's the worst case wind conditions that you typically would fly in? What's kind of the maximum wind speed that you would consider safe to fly?
For your average one, I'd say 10 to 15 knots. Some of the bigger ones, the DJI Inspire and some of their larger ones can handle a little bit more. But 10 to 15 knots is probably realistically a safe place to stay. So it's your average day.
Yeah. Would you briefly describe any gotchas about the handling of the batteries that were briefly mentioned? They're obviously high-density batteries.
The biggest issue with the batteries today is just understanding how to charge them. I mean, the technology in the batteries is the same technology in our cell phones. So the technology in your laptop. So you're carrying around a lot of these lithium packs anyway. But there are some gotchas with how far you want to run the batteries down, things like that. But a lot of the newer ones, such as this Chroma, the DJI Phantom, and others, have safety provisions kind of built into them, so they won't allow it to reach below a certain voltage. It will actually come home prior to running it down to the point where you start to damage the battery. So, and then most of these, they've now taken a lot of the charging capabilities out of the owner's hands. You're forced to use their chargers, things like that. So they're controlling the charge rates, whereas in the RC world, Bill and I routinely will charge packs at much higher rates just because it's a lot of the manufacturers it's okay to do, but these guys kind of keep everything at the, like the DJI packs, for example, as soon as you land, when the packs are warm, the charger will not allow it to charge because it's actually monitoring internal temperature on the battery and saying, okay, wait, this is too high. It forces it to cool down before you're able to plug it back in. So more and more of the manufacturers are starting to build some of the safety provisions into the charging of the batteries. Whereas a few years ago, it was kind of the wild, wild west, and you had to kind of know what you were doing, and several people burned down houses. And
something interesting about that battery question that I would add to this, I'm sure that the 3DR and DJI is the same way. I took this purposely into that low voltage situation. And it starts flashing red on all four corners and came right down and landed. I didn't do a thing. When you take off with this, it creates where you are a spot and puts a 15-foot circle around you, okay? And the return to home is just outside of that 15-foot circle. The 15-foot circle is there so that if you get silly, you can't fly it into your face. I mean, you know, it's a very nice safety feature.
I just want to...
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Hi. I just had a quick question. You're saying that the TSA decided to rip your camera off. What was their reasoning for that, or are they just...
Just a complete lack of respect for someone else's property.
Okay.
They didn't even
mention
the battery.
Okay.
No. It was clearly when they tried to stuff it back in the case that it got hung up or something and they forced it. That's what it looks like.
And you know, obviously, the industry and the academy work closely together, and so we're fortunate to be able to get a lot of equipment to test and to fly and to demonstrate here for you. Like, this is Horizon Hobbies from Champaign, Illinois, the distributor for this. And the Chroma is a very popular platform. And it's in its own Pelican case. And, you know, traveling with lithium batteries is kind of an issue. And I would have expected maybe the battery to be taken out or, jacked with or whatever. But ripping the camera off, I mean, they just pull it off and all the mounting stuff's gone and that. So, you know, yeah, I don't know. As Arch said, you know, carry it on. So, lesson learned.
They took two reasonably good-sized plastic tabs and were completely snapped off. I mean, the amount of force it must have taken to even get it to do that was...
I just wanted to ask a question, if I may, about the payload, maximum payload, I guess, that you can... carry on one of these drones. You said the AV cannot exceed 55 pounds. What is the, if you take into consideration the typical weight of one of these drones, how much payload are we talking about, worst case, that they accommodate?
The biggest ones I've seen and actually flown was the aircraft weighed about 50 pounds at takeoff, and about 18 pounds of that was payload. And that was one of the largest multi-rotors I've seen. Since then, I've actually seen some much larger ones. DOD plays with some. They don't have to play by the 55-pound rule. There are some exceptions to that also that people can get. So there was an EPA box that some guys were doing some testing with. The idea was being able to fly downwind from a forest fire and determining some of the components of the fire, things like that, or theoretically in a nuclear disaster, that kind of stuff, being able to fly in, and some of that was getting into the 40 and 50 pound payload size. So the issue is duration with a multi-rotor. The more weight you put on it, the less time you get.
I do have a question. Bill, I know that most of the stations, television stations particularly, are starting to use drones for news gathering, as well as I've seen some sports events have them. Does your school help educate on how to do this, or is this strictly, I know tomorrow we have an attorney coming in talking about what you can and cannot do, but is this something that someone can go to really get a good feel before we let them out in Lambeau Field?
It's the Wild West right now, Linda. I mean, to be honest with you, I'll just say a few things here briefly about this, and then Arch can get into all the FAA talk because he does that much better than me. Look, if you are making money flying, you're breaking the law. It's just that simple. If you're making money, you're breaking the law. Now, are there workarounds to that? Here's a classic one. Well, I'm taking pictures of, you know, my wife's real estate listings, and I'm not charging her anything to fly and take these pictures, these videos. I'm charging her for editing. Okay, really? Well, you know, and on a small scale, I don't think the FAA or anyone's going to chase that down. Look, with a million new ones coming out at Christmas, what's the FAA going to do? Those of you familiar with aviation, I mean, you know, Bill was saying earlier that he used to fly. Where's Bill? Okay, he used to have his private pilot's license. Hadn't flown in a long time. It's not current. I guarantee you he could go to any airport, get in an airplane, take off, fly, come back, land, put it away, and the FAA would do nothing about it unless it went bad. I mean, it's just really that simple. So when we have this conversation, someone mentioned a tower, putting a waypoint to a tower. Why would you put a waypoint? Why not stand at the base of the tower and fly up it and inspect it and videotape it and just call it a good time?
Because we're on the clock, and there's the ethics question.
Well, maybe you do that after work. I don't know.
But you're on company property, on company time, whether it's company property as the drone, or me, my personal self, have been doing it for a couple of years with a helicopter, where I have one guy sighting, I'm flying, and one guy's watching the camera.
Right.
So there's where, in the ethical realm, or even not ethical realm, what's the line between commercial and hobby at that point for us being broadcasters? Like I said, I'm using it to inspect towers. I've also run into the problem of, don't inspect a 50,000 watt FM with one of these things. They kind of fall out of the sky because they get confused because there's too much RF. So
yeah, I've heard that from AM too. I don't know.
What's the ethical line of, I'm doing this professionally, yeah, as I'm inspecting my property, I'm being paid on the clock, versus a hobby who's flying it to look at the tower?
By FAA definition, currently, that would be breaking the law. However, the FAA has openly said that there are certain things they're going after and other ones they're not. I mean, if you have the property, the odds are there's not an FAA guy walking up on you, you're not putting it on YouTube. I'm not going to say you should do that, but nobody's going to show up and do that. I mean, one of the videos Bill and I saw today, maybe one of the worst I've ever seen. A guy literally flew across the Golden Gate Bridge with cars and transited across filming this, and a significant number of people that were on this forum were commenting about how great a video it was, and I'm just sitting there just shaking my head, just terrified. So there are also exceptions you can get. You can get a 333 exception currently, which allows businesses to do that. But by definition right now, anything for profit is technically illegal. And to get back to your point with, or a question with the education side, the Academy itself doesn't actually have a school. We actually have people that write most of our stuff, Fly Robotics, fly-robotics.com. They've actually written a course that's geared specifically toward passing the NPRM test, which Bill saw an email earlier we got that right now they're shooting for June of next year to be able to get a commercial license for these things. So that's kind of the date I was hoping for, and it looks like that very well may come to fruition. So it's $99 if you're not an AMA member, $79 if you are. It's a really impressive course written by some of the best UAV guys out there. I mean, I'll admit it, I was one of the guys. So myself and a couple other guys that wrote it, we've got about 10 to 12,000 hours of operational UAV experience from everything from backpackable Ravens, and then I've got unbelievable numbers of hours with these, all the way up to Predator, Global Hawk type aircraft. So anybody knows that it's the guys that put that one together. So
very quickly, I always like this story. When the gentleman asked about weight and this whole thing about what's right, and Linda's saying the TV guys are coming and, you know, these TV folks are, you know, are using them and all that. Do you remember when the Boston bomber was found in the boat? They got that infrared video footage from a FLIR camera that was probably on a Bell helicopter of some kind that that law enforcement agency had deployed. And so you have a big-time jet-powered helicopter leaned up over like that, 100 foot over this neighborhood, getting that footage of the infrared signature of this guy in the boat. What happens if that goes bad? I mean, you're going to burn 30 houses down. You're going to kill hundreds of people. But that's okay. Taking that up is not okay. To do the exact same thing. You know, the two things that are most oppressed right now in this whole drone conversation is education. You know, when you talk about what you're doing, and is that okay? You know, the University of Wisconsin cannot have in its curriculum any kind of drone training because somebody's making money, the professor or somebody. It's illegal. I mean, are you kidding me? In an educational setting, the other group's public safety. We have the capability right now to have a smartphone strapped to your wrist, give that to a SWAT team, have one of these loiter over a house with bad guys in it, and give them an infrared signature that's real time of where the bad guys are. Can't do it. It's illegal. Now, the good news is that Rule 107, which is the result of the NPRM, that you know how all that works, Rule 107 will allow relief to all of this and will have some guidelines to go on. And it is a 55-pound weight limit. And that weight limit allows a lot of things. If you've ever seen a 55-pound model airplane, it's big, okay? And that's good because then you can put some telemetry on a big model airplane and really do agriculture properly. These can't do 1,000-acre farm fields. Are you kidding me? But a big model airplane could. What do we get out of that one? How much?
Yeah, we did some testing on one in Northwest Ohio, and it looks like we could do maintaining visual line of sight and everything else, 2,000 to 25 acres in 3 to 4 hours with the agricultural stuff, and that aircraft's under 20 pounds. And it's gas-powered, so it can stay up for a significant amount of time, but we could cover a huge amount of ground in a short amount of time and get really impressive footage for the agriculture.
And so that's an exciting technology.
And that was a $700 off-the-shelf camera. It was basically, it just looked for near IR, and it's measuring the amount of chlorophyll in a plant. So you fly over a cornfield, and you can identify an area. It doesn't tell you, you can use multispectral, which is a couple hundred thousand dollars. It tells you what's wrong. With NDVI, which is really cheap, you can at least identify a problem area. So if you've got a 3,000-acre cornfield, and you've got 800 acres in the middle of it, once the corn's above 5 foot tall, nobody's walking out there. Well, what if we can, before that corn gets quite that tall, we can identify where the problems are, and now you can justify going out there because you know the area you're going to. And that's easily put together for $2,000 with the autopilot systems and stuff today. I mean, that would be absolutely be worth it from a farmer's standpoint to, before I go out, I mean, John Deere and others are looking about almost doing real-time spraying. So an aircraft flies ahead or even tethered to the tractor, scanning back, and on the spray bars, being able to modify them so that instead of spraying everything, almost go valve to valve. So as they're getting real-time data back plant to plant, they're able to do health inspections with multispectral and then adjust the sprays according to what that plant actually needs. And Purdue and Kansas State are talking yield numbers of increasing 20 to 25% over the next 10 years, just with the use of the technology that's out there now. And that's a huge number. I mean, how many farms do you see have a bad winter or bad summer and now they don't get anything? Well, what if we can identify those problems a lot earlier?
More questions?
Actually, I'll throw one in here real quick and then I'll get over to you, Jason. We're looking right now at the University of Wisconsin at developing some policies around drone operation as we have students bringing these to campus. Obviously, we don't want them flying over athletic fields or in our residence life areas. Are there any guidelines available through your organization that might help us develop those?
Yes. We have two things. We have a thing called MASC, M-A-S-C, Model Aviation Student Club, and we have the University Model Aviation Student Club. that you can form an AMA club, a flying club, and all of those students will receive membership for $15, because we were college kids once, and receive the site owner insurance, which is $3 million, and it costs $80 a year to insure the university or a landowner somewhere near the university that would give you a place to fly, okay? That's the key, where do you do this? You know, in 80 years, the AMA has an incredible safety record. I mean, I think there's been like two, is that right?
It's been a hand, I mean, you can count on one hand.
You can count on one hand the number of fatalities that the Academy of Model Aeronautics has experienced in 80 years of doing this. And the reason for that is not because we don't crash airplanes, because trust me, we do. The reason for that is because of where we do it. And the same thing applies to this, if you think about it. You know, to your University of Wisconsin, having a student club for model aviation and establishing that, and then when they fly, and they're flying for fun, okay, this isn't part of a course requirement or anything like that, it's all good. It's just fine to do that. So yeah, we do have that. But at the end of the day, you know, this is the Wild West. And when you have some folks doing silly things, it's really sensationalized. The FAA said there were 900 sightings of drones by commercial airline pilots. Have you, I mean, we fly a lot, but if you've flown lately, looked out the window, and if you see a cloud or something that's close, how fast that goes by, can you imagine something that big and you're really able to identify it? And as it turns out, only about 10% of those are maybes. The rest of them were, you know, I mean,
anything. I mean, even a bird can be
sensationalized. You know, it's so sensationalized. And I know that Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, they're running big commercial jet engines from Rolls-Royce, which is in Indianapolis, and they're throwing drones in them. Doesn't do a thing. They eat the drones, just like they do, you know, a bird or two. Not a bunch of birds, but one or two.
The other thing I'd add to that would be the kids are going to do it regardless. So if you're better off into trying to encourage them, hey, we'll use this field hockey field on Tuesdays for an evening. You guys can come out here, and maybe tomorrow we'll go over here. So if you give them a place to do it and a way to do it safely, you're probably going to mitigate the risk instead of them going out on walking in front of a dorm and doing something really stupid. So.
Yeah, and Arch brings up a good point. You know, a lot of people, and maybe some of you have thought this too, you guys have so much fun flying model airplanes and model helicopters. Why are you jacking with this thing? Well, if we don't, who will? We have got to give these operators a place to be legitimized. We have to. Because there's no one else in the United States that can do it. It has to be the AMA. And with all due respect, and at my age I can say this, this is not a young crowd. Okay? It's not. And the cool thing about this for us is, and one of the reasons it's so exciting, it's new. How much new stuff is there, really? I mean, not much. You know, it might have a new, panel on the front of the amp you're looking at or whatever, but, I mean, what's new about this, really? Okay? This is really new and exciting. And if you don't think kids light up over this, you're mistaken. And one of the interesting things about it, and it's been very difficult for me to sell our members on this, because our members look just like this room. They feel very threatened by these because they don't want to lose what they've got. They don't want to lose their model airplane field. Those of you that have been around some model airplane guys or some AMA clubs, I see heads going up and down. They, you know, they're just scared to death that any day now, the FAA is going to say, it's over. Well, that's not going to happen here. The FAA has said that's not going to happen here, okay? Model aviation, as we know it today, is not threatened, okay? And we're not going to let this threaten us. But you can't legislate everything. Let's educate, okay? Will they all come and learn? No. But certainly, if we don't do it, none of them will. So that's our take on our approach here and why we're doing this. Question right here.
Yeah, just a couple things. As a photographer, I'm very familiar with what I have the right to shoot and what I don't. If I'm in public space and I can legally obtain a photo, I'm well within my rights to do so. If I have to do something illegal like trespass to obtain a photo, well, then it's no longer a legally obtained photo. So I'm kind of curious, when it comes to vertical space, is there any hard, fast rule about how much vertical space above someone's property is actually what they would consider to be private?
The FAA will tell you that they control all of the airspace in the national airspace 1 foot and above.
Okay.
Good luck with that, right? Yeah. I mean, are you kidding me?
If so, I could ask, I know that, you know, that's FAA, but if I could ask one more question regarding the whole commercial aspect of that. We got a newspaper. Somebody in the community has a drone. They went downtown, they found that historic building, they took some wonderful footage of it, flying around the top of that building, it's empty. They're, you know, everybody thought it was great. We take it, we put it on our website. It's not behind a paywall, but there certainly is advertising supporting that website. Is that now suddenly an illegal commercial usage?
The way the FAA has written it, and they've actually gone after people for that, yes. They've started backing off on that to some degree because they've got other people to go after, but by definition, yes. And your previous question, it goes state to state. There, I believe it's the state of Washington. For some reason, you own 58 feet above the highest point on your property. It's some random number. I have no idea what it is. It's not even right in meters, but state to state define how much above your property you technically own. But if a Cessna goes in circles over your house at 500 feet, there's nothing you can do about it. So there is a point where you could theoretically be over somebody and not have to deal with it.
I think there was an interesting event out somewhere on the beach. A family's laying out in the sun, and some guy comes up over them with a multi-rotor like this and is filming them. And the guy didn't want any part of that, so he took a towel or something.
That was the woman. He was filming a woman laying out, and she's the one that went over and knocked it out of the sky and then ran after the guy and started beating him. And he actually filed assault charges. And
so he filed assault charges and damages, and she had to pay for his multi-rotor.
And the reasoning was, as you were on a public beach, if you don't want to be filmed, go inside. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not like it's some kind of Kirby spy video.
I know.
But you don't know that in the drone.
Yeah.
That's part of the education.
Right.
The video that these drones are producing, for the most part, is wide angle shots. It's not
right. And in my personal experience, the people that complain the most about invasion of privacy and don't film my house look like me. Nobody's out filming me. I'm sorry. I accept that. That's realistic. It's the guys that nobody has any interest to be over your house. So.
And I agree with you, but I will say that the GoPro and that fisheye video that, you know, many, many, many of us have seen and are still very popular on multi-rotors, this does not have a fisheye lens at all. It is really pretty good. And, you know, at 4X, the pixel count, I mean.
It's still wide angle, though. So the quality is still, I mean, you're still looking at relatively a small.
You're not
even
up close.
Even zoomed in, you're not getting really detailed stuff.
Yeah, you're not up close.
I just wanted to ask, all right, do I understand that you provide training for flying drones And if the person comes to you and wants to learn how to fly drones, how long does it take?
Well, if they're a private pilot, it takes a long time. No, I'm kidding, Bill. Actually, our worst students are private pilots. You know, at the end of the day, we, as the Academy of Model Aeronautics, it's interesting that that's our name, because we get calls from people wanting to drop their kids off for the summer. That's not what we do, okay? It should probably be the Association or the American or whatever, and you know, it just is what it is. Something that started in 1936, it's not gonna change now, but the Academy, we have an online course that addresses the NPRM, and when Rule 107 is adopted, that course will immediately adjust, if necessary, to be able to pass an FAA written exam, okay? Learning to fly is a different story, okay?
And not required by the NPRM. There's no physical flight test. By the way they've written the rule, you don't have to prove to anybody you know how to fly. You just have to be able to pass a written test.
So. But I think we all know if it takes off, it's coming down. And you know, to me, while the automated features of these are really neat and impressive, you really owe it to yourself, your family, and anyone else if you consider doing this, you know, in any kind of professional setting, to be able to fly it manually. Because if it does go bad, that's the only thing between you and it hitting something.
Are you working at all with the EAA?
Regarding
general aviation type?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, well, Arch was just.
Right, so EAA is obviously somebody we do a lot with Young Eagles and such. I was at Oshkosh this summer, spent a lot of time up there talking to guys, and for the most part, most of the comments were positive. We did get a couple guys that were causing all these crashes and such with the hobby side. However, I think what you're gonna see over the next several years is going to have to be a compromise on both sides. For years, the EAA and your Joe Farmer out in Iowa has been, you're not gonna put a transponder on my aircraft because you're not gonna know where I'm flying. Well, welcome to 2015. You carry a cell phone, everybody knows where you're at anyway. So we're getting to the point now where there's a lot of technology that can be adopted to make a lot of this stuff safe, but it's got to be compromised from both sides, not just these guys, because the money is getting thrown into these because there's so many other applications. I mean, from a communication standpoint, there's several companies out there working with tethered versions of these. So they're basically portable towers that can stay up infinite amount of time, and by the definition, they're tethered. They're not actually flying, so they don't have to play with any of the rules. Yep, and some of them, they've even got some of the ADS-B stuff down to cell phone size now, right. So when you start doing that, now it gives the ability for radar and things to know where these things are. And some of the sense and avoid technology out there that they're working on, I was working on a project with the Navy, it was $24 million and worked at one airport. So it's not cheap, but the technology's out there and now it'll start getting cheaper. But step one is going to be not only knowing where all these things are, but you need to know where everybody else is as well. So
as a private pilot, are there any other or extra regulations that apply to me in the operation of this that may not apply to someone else?
As far as if you own one or?
Yes.
The biggest thing you have is having your private pilot makes it very easy for you to get your 333 exception. So legally, you can very easily go get your, because you already meet all the requirements of having and actually having a ticket. It does not have to be current. I don't understand that, but you don't have to be.
But here's the bad part about that. Mm-hmm. Do you have your private pilot's license? You do. Anyone else in here operate a multi-rotor that does not have a private pilot's license? Okay. He does something silly, it's a lot harder for the FAA to do something to him than it is to you.
Right.
Okay. Because there's always the threat of them pulling your tags, okay, for doing something silly. And you know, that's just how it is. Oh. Yes, sir.
Hi there. Another question here. My hobby that I'm in, and we deal with a lot of similar issues with idiots and all that, is rocketry. And one of the things we do, if we need to fly high or whatever, or you have people who want to, and you've got the recovery space, we coordinate with, you know, FAA with waivers and local air traffic control, because there's times you send rockets 18, 20,000 feet or more. If you guys wanted to do something that was above 400 feet or so, or go into that 500-foot space, do you guys have a method for coordinating with local places?
Yes, the way the NPRM is written is initially it's going to be no class, it's defined ABC, or basically controlled airspace, so no ABCD, whatever. Obviously nobody's at 18,000 feet, so A is kind of out, but there are provisions in there that if you let the tower know where and when you're operating, and they do not have to give you permission, but you can say and talk to the tower and coordinate those things. And I think there's going to be some of that with, I mean, some of these radio towers, you know, you're way above 400 feet. So, but if you're out in the middle of a cornfield somewhere, whatever, you're not seeing any traffic anyway. So there's not going to be a lot of problems there. But in congested airspace, there are provisions for certain scenarios where you can get permission to go above that. And like Bill said, recreationally, we bust it all the time. I mean, I'm fairly certain with my jet, I'm at 2,000 feet plus, so.
Yeah, and Arch mentioned his jet. He's got a jet. And when I say jet, I don't mean jet, toy jet. I mean a jet. It's a real turbine that burns real jet fuel or kerosene or diesel fuel with some oil in it. And the machining on that engine is incredible. And it sounds and smells just like a jet. And it's one of the coolest things ever to come out of our hobby. If you've not YouTube a search sometime of some RC jets, and it's incredible what they do. And the only reason I mention that is the Wisconsin here, the connection that you probably have, many of you, with Oshkosh, this summer past was the second consecutive summer that we've had AMA members as part of a flight demo out on the main flight line flying RC right there. I mean, right up front on the main flight line with Matt Chapman, who's an aerobatic big name and an AMA member and likes to fly model airplanes. So that's been very cool. And the two of the high-ranking guys at EAA are absolute model airplane nuts. Sean Elliott's just clear into it. So, and he's their FAA government relations guy. So yeah, to answer that question, we interact with them, if not daily, for sure weekly. You know, good bunch of guys. Yes, sir.
I got a question. Some of the rules that cover hot air ballooning, how much close could they, or how similar could they be to this? Because where I live, which is just northeast of town, we've had hot air balloons, and I've seen them within a mile at airport, you know, which is a commercial airport with a lot of jet planes coming in and out.
I think it goes back to right now the FAA looks for these. I mean, there are things that happen all the time with, and I'm sure there is some coordination, I know, with balloons and such, but absolutely, there are times that manned aviation, well, an example that I hate to use because it was a terrible scenario, but the crash of the F-16 and a Cessna this summer. I mean, to say that manned aviation is perfect, I mean, here we had an aircraft with an onboard air-to-air radar on a perfectly clear day, still ran over a small Cessna. How does that happen with the technology that's on board? So, but the issue is that was on the news for a day or two. If one of these things went bad, you're looking at the next month, they're out headhunting and everything else that's out there. So it happens all the time, it's just not, they're supposed to do exactly the same things that you would for this, but whether or not they do, the FAA may or not.
I think when they operate in an airspace, they're supposed to notify the airport.
Yep.
I mean, with these vehicles and stuff, I would think similar rules could be in place. If you're going to do something, you know, just general recreational real close to the airport, I could see, you know, restrictions on and stuff. But I know that they lumber over my house coming in at, you know, 1,000, 1,500 feet at times. And,
at least on the hot air balloon, it's one of the issues we have here. You've still had to go through some kind of aeronautical test. They have their own rating that you can get for that. And they're supposed to be carrying an aviation radio. Whereas trying to convince some of these guys that I fly with of how to talk on a radio, that can be another story. But that's all supposed to get covered with the FAA, with the NPRM coming out, that And today you can buy a handheld radio that you can listen to aviation frequencies and stuff that for a couple hundred bucks, and it shouldn't be an issue. So,
yeah, could a simple radio beacon just be put on it? A plane could detect it when it's in the area?
Yeah, and that goes back to what we were talking about with ADS-B earlier. I mean, the technology exists to make it very easy to see these things and avoid. The issue is whether or not every person with their private, with their Cherokee 140, puts that technology in the aircraft, because it is expensive.
It's the same thing as FAA protecting old radios. I mean, we have a lot of interference issues, and we know that FAA is protecting probably obsolete radios in planes.
Absolutely, and a lot of it is driven by cost, but unfortunately, what's happening now is there's so much investment stuff. I mean, look what Amazon's doing. Google swears they're going to have 100,000 aircraft over LA on January 1, 2017. For communication, internet, and all this other stuff. Now, we'll see. I mean, even at a 99.99 success rate, that still means one of them is going to fall. And if one of them falls in the wrong spot, everybody's coming down, and they're going to shut it down for a while. So it's probably a far-reaching goal, but these things are coming. There's huge amounts of money being thrown into it, so you're going to start seeing a lot of this stuff evolve and change over the next few years.
Another question.
Radio question. What frequencies are used for the control link to the aircraft, and what frequencies are used for the telemetry and the video back down?
Most of it is 2.4 for the communication link. This one's 2.4 for both. Some of them are 2.4 and 5.8. And then some of the military stuff is 900 megahertz, as well as there's some commercial stuff coming out now. And a lot of this stuff, technically, people are supposed to have their FCC license and things like that, which nobody's not enforcing that one either.
So are you sharing that with Wi-Fi frequencies?
It's in the same band, but it's dedicated frequencies inside that.
Okay, I'm just wondering about interference and range of the signals, and how far away can you get from the aircraft before you lose control of it?
Most of that stuff today is a couple miles. It's usually digital, and it's usually tied to the 2.4 stuff is usually encrypted with the transmitter. So even though multiple, you can take out 50 of these and put them together, and they're not going to interfere with each other because they're all in generally the same frequency band. Most of it's frequency hopping, and it's tied to that transmitters and receiver. So all the noise it's getting, it's going, hey, wait a minute, I'm ignoring you anyway. So.
I'll give you a real tough question. When you were flying that, you had the lights on. Is it a requirement when it's flying you have to have the lights on?
No, but on a lot of them, they put them on there for orientation, because even in bright daylight, it does make a difference. I haven't seen that one outside, but I know on my Inspire, it's very, very easy to see these LED lights, even in bright sunlight.
And it's also telling you what's going on, which flight mode you're in, battery conditions. Like, all four turned red and started flashing when I got low power and it landed automatically. If it's in the safe mode, two of the lights are blue, two are white. If it's in the manual mode, like Arch was flying a minute ago, all the lights are white. So it is a visual reference, but it's also giving you some information.
Okay, so it's much more the lights are much more complicated than just the white lights.
Yes.
And unfortunately, there's no standard to that either. So every different manufacturer has different lights that do different things. So.
Yes, sir.
You want to touch on FPV, first-person view, and
sure.
Use the multirotors. That's what I fly with mine. I've got one of the little 250 size.
Well, yeah. The FPV racing, that's first-person view, where the camera on the multirotor or the airplane or whatever, you're wearing a set of goggles or you're looking at a screen. There's a lot of ways to do that, but it's putting you inside the aircraft, and it's crazy popular. It's just exploded. It's an amazing thing. He's got one. I've got one that I'm putting together. I'm anxious to try it. My only issue with it is getting used to that up-in-your-face view and the goggles. You know, that's going to take some getting used to for me. I'm fine if I'm looking at a screen, but I'll work around that. But the FPV thing and the racing and all that is great. I mean, when he's talking about 250s, you're talking about a multi-rotor, you know, about so long. You know, it's not very big, it's not very threatening, and you know, everybody's racing around different courses, and some people are out in a woods racing around trails and hitting trees and...
Yeah, but see, that touches on the issue. I live within 3 miles of the airport. I live over by Warner Park, and it's really close to the airport. It's a great place to fly. You'll never actually go over the height of the trees, and there's no airplane that's ever going to be anywhere near close.
Don't let anybody see you. Don't let anybody see you.
Yeah, but that's the issue, is it's still violating rules or, you know...
I understand that, and the rule will help that some, but, you know, the 3 miles of an airport's not going to go away. But when you're talking about 40 foot off the ground, maybe max,
yeah. You
know, don't let anybody see you doing it. Don't have 50 guys show up for a big race.
I
know, it does. It's a vicious circle. But here's the bad part about FPV. Are the guys that want to put on those goggles and put a camera on whatever it is they're flying and go how many miles downrange have we been told?
Well, we got told 27, but...
Oh, there's a guy that flew over 100 kilometers away.
Yeah, see, that is...
Well, there's a guy that says he flew over 100 kilometers away.
That is so lame in decision-making and safety considerations that, you know, it's just off the charts. That's the bad part about FPV. The FPV within the AMA is still line of sight. So that, you know, if I'm flying FPV, I need to have someone around there. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it'd be someone that could watch 4 or 5 guys, for that matter, you know. But someone needs to be standing there watching what's going on without the goggles on, okay? Because there's nothing like, you know, situational awareness to look around and say, oh, wow, here comes the Cessna 172. But FPV is really cool. It's a lot of fun. And that whole thing about proximity to an airport, my club is in that zone. So we have to call the tower in Muncie, Indiana, and say, hi, this is Bill Pritchett. We're going to fly small airplanes for a little bit. We'll call you when we're finished. And they always say, hey, Bill, how you doing? Okay, have a great day. And the reason is my club sends them gift certificates to restaurants 2 or 3 times a year. Okay? I mean, don't kid yourself. And so we've gotten to know them, and we take them coffee mugs full of chocolate at Christmas and stuff like that. So what's interesting, though, is then doing us a favor, when full-scale approaches come in, they will say, be aware that 3 miles west of 32, there's model aviation activity. So now these guys drop to 300 feet and fly over us because they want to see.
But there are provisions in there inside the 3 miles that if you decided to form an FPV racing club, if you talk to the tower, you can absolutely get permission to, okay, here's where we're at, and they say, okay, fine. And a lot of the guys are open to it. I mean, especially if you show up bearing gifts. And say, hey, here's what we're doing. And the other thing is show them what you've got. I mean, walk in with a 250 quad and say, here's what we're doing. Here's the map. Here's where we're at. We're down below tree level. Most places, I don't think you're going to have much of issue with it.
And I'll tell you right now that at the AMA Expo, which is in Ontario, California, the second weekend in January, we are going to have an FPV race, and that is 1.5 miles from the Ontario airport. And we're going to have a 40-foot max ceiling, and I think we're probably going to end up netting some of it. But yeah, we're going to do it right there ourselves.
It's just so fun.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. It's such a quick and easy way to break something. You know?
Oh.
I know it. I know it.
And another example is I'm not within 3 or 5 miles of an airport, but I live down at Pax River, Maryland, so I'm inside the restricted area. So technically, if the base is operational, I shouldn't be able to walk outside and do anything because I'm in restricted airspace, not just proximity to the airport. That one I don't have as much problem with because there are some real interesting people. The problem with the one downtown, though, is you can walk into the Smithsonian and buy a Phantom or any of this other stuff, but you can't actually walk outside and fly it, and there's nobody in there telling you you can't do that. So the problem is not the people that do this right. It's the fact that there's absolutely, from a technology standpoint, and years of DoD experiences. There's nothing out there that would stop me taking my 25-pound jet, filling it full of high explosives with an autopilot and launching it from a Walmart parking lot and putting it somewhere, and you're not stopping it. The technology exists, so what they have to do is build these rings and things around it. And yes, it punishes the guys that do it right. But you have to start with, all right, this is where our limitations are, and then back some of that off. As the technology evolves with line of sight and sense and avoid, as well as some of the other return home commands, and I'm part of a test where we're actually going to test. One of the big problems has been the fire issues, where guys decide to take a great picture, and they're stopping firefighters from being able to bring in the aircraft over it, because they're trying to get the magic shot. Well, there's a huge test going on now of what can that public safety people on the ground do to prevent that. So I'm actually part of a test where we're going to start testing some anti-drone technology to how do we clear that airspace so that these guys can come in and drop the water, which will save $500,000 worth of homes because some guy decided he had to get the perfect shot with his Phantom.
Okay, well, hey, the nut and the bolt, thank you. We haven't decided which one, whether it was Gary or Bill, but you guys can sort that out. This is a wonderful thing. Linda, I appreciate you providing beer and brats to attract a crowd for us. That's genius. Okay? Yeah. And, yeah. So thank you very much, and we're going to be here if you have any additional questions or whatever. I think you go into a different session. So
this was so much fun. I think if you want to talk with either Bill or with Archie, by all means, please come up and do so. Thank you very much. Let's give them another round of applause, please.
Thank you.
Resident Results, Shively Labs, and the Marriott, thank you for the beer, the brats, and the burgers. We appreciate it all very, very much.